Hello and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. I am Aaron Flores, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia. We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way, covering bicycles, trains, transit, and simpler living, and today, bike journalism. And I did all that from memory, folks. That's right, I'm actually memorizing the script card for a change. Today, we have an interview with Jonathan Maus of BikePortland.org, and I just got a message that interrupted this song, but I'm having such a great fifth take on this intro that I am not going to edit that out. So we got Jonathan Maus from BikePortland.org. I have no co-host with me today due to a scheduling snafu. My friend Lisa couldn't make it in. She is currently out traveling. So Lisa, if you are listening to this, happy travels. Come back soon. Come back safe. And speaking of coming back, Brock and Adele will be here. They're planning on arriving back in Portland around August 6th. So mark your calendars and set off your fireworks for those of you in Portland. And those of you not in Portland, go ahead and set off your fireworks as well because, you know, why not? And people will be mystified. So this was a pre-recorded interview we have with Jonathan. I'm going to put that up as well as Brock and Adele's week four and five updates from their life out on the road. This is going to be one of those Aaron Light episodes. But before that, a couple things I would like to mention just somewhat personal notes. This funny thing happened to me while I was biking a couple days ago, just riding from place to place. Speaking of which, I'm just going to take a quick peek out the window at my bike here. Still there. Just riding from the store back to the house was really tough. I don't know what was going on. It was kind of early in the morning, so I wasn't thinking maybe the most critically, but I was going through kind of this existential funk because of it. I was beginning to think like, oh, this is it. This is the beginning of the end. My legs are giving out. It's time for me to get old and start calming down, I guess. And I wasn't in that hard of a gear, and I kept gearing down, and like it wasn't getting any easier. And yeah, I was just thinking, oh, yeah, my legs are giving out. It's time to stop biking as hard as I usually do. No more trips up and down Mount Tabor 4 or 5 times a week. And then I got home and realized my rear brake had locked up. Turns out I just changed the pads and I didn't set the pads in correctly. So the inside one became unseated and just stuck to the rotor. Hey, so existential crisis averted. The other thing I want to mention is I know a lot of you listeners have written to us talking about how much you laughed over listening to my brother and I kind of riff off each other on an episode of The Sprocket. And he's going to be in town pretty soon, the weekend of October 8th and 9th and into Wednesday, August, sorry, folks. 8th and 9th, and then into the 11th and 12th. And it just so happens that Leah Benson of Gladys Bikes and her brother Brian Benson will be on the show during that. So there's going to be maybe some kind of Benson Flores face-off of some kind. Don't know what that's going to look like, but it'll be fun. I hope you guys will tune in for that. And yeah, I'm sure we'll all be sharing some laughs. Yeah, so I'll get out of your way. We'll do this interview. I am going to post some mail onto the site along with this, but I'm not going to read any other than the fact that I think it's important to point out Cameron Lane or Lean Line. Please, I'm sorry for mutilating your last name there, Cameron, has signed on to be our newest monthly donor. Thank you very much, Cameron. Okay, so without further ado, on to this interview. I did not mean for that to rhyme. Anyways, I'll see you all on the other side. So I grabbed a couple drinks. I got kombucha and I got beer.
Cool.
I don't know, like being that it's 2 o'clock, whether you want to crack open.
I've been beering a lot lately. The kombucha sounds good.
Okay.
Awesome. These little bottles remind me of little tincture jars from some old pharmacy.
That's
cheers.
Cheers. Yeah, I think that's what they're modeled after.
It's like a drink of medicine.
Snake oil. Oh, dang.
Yeah.
That is
ginger can be powerful.
Holy crap. That's combined with the cayenne.
Oh, yeah.
This is the second time I've done an interview with cayenne, actually, as a drink.
Is that right?
Maria Schur. I interviewed her in her kitchen, no less. And it was just, that's the way our schedules wound up. She brewed coffee with cayenne.
Did she?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. Coffee and cayenne, that kind of goes with what I feel and think about when I think about Maria. She's
personality.
It fits the personality, right? I mean, she's always kind of up and doing something cool and unexpected, and you know, that's really neat.
Kicked my ass.
Cayenne and caffeine.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, it was good. I think it was. It would have been better if I had like cream and sugar in it. That's how she drinks it.
Ooh. Okay.
Because then you get like the sweet and the hot.
Nice. Okay. Right.
But I was drinking it black, and it was just punching me in the face with every sip. Anyways, the Sprocket Podcast is here with Jonathan Maus. I want to pronounce it because it's M-A-U-S. I keep wanting to pronounce it Maus.
Yeah, it is with a Z. It's more like pause with an M.
Okay.
Maus. I know in Germany you're going to say Maus.
Right, right.
But that's just how we've always said Maus.
Maus.
With a Z.
Okay.
You know, so.
That's the way we'll do it.
Great. All right, sounds good.
On everybody's mind, and you said it was on the front page of the Oregonian today, which I did not read, so I'll have to do that soon, is East Portland and what's going on there.
Yeah, from a lot of different facets, right? Not just from our transportation world, but a lot of other issues.
Right, right. Just the... Well, and you were talking mostly of the power structure, but just I was saying earlier, urban renewal is the key word, or is the new phrase that a lot of people are saying. And there's just generally a lot of growth out there. A lot of people who are being pushed out there are a lot of people who are coming to Portland and realizing, hey, that's where the cheap real estate is.
Right, right.
Yeah, so... Give us your I don't know, 20-second, 40-minute spiel.
Well, our spiel, let's see. Well, I remember it, from my perspective, the East Portland thing, I can kind of trace it back to one specific story, at least in my world of the transportation bike beat, you know, that I've been covering since about 2005. It was 2008 when then Transportation Commissioner Sam Adams, who ended up being mayor, of course, he had this idea to take the Savi Island Bridge, you know, this old antique bridge to connect the Savi Island Highway 30, and put it in downtown Portland over I-405 on Flanders.
Okay.
This is 2008. It was a really interesting proposal. Had quite a bit of support from some people in the community. Anyway, that was his mayoral campaign. It was the same time as when he was running for mayor for the first time against a guy named Sho DiZono. And it was within the context of that project and that mayoral race that I first heard, at least politically, this issue about equity and East Portland not having it as well as downtown, in terms, especially in a transportation lens, that's when I first heard that become a major, major rallying cry, because Sho DiZono tried to use it against Sam Adams by saying, we're not going to go spend millions of bucks to put a brand new bridge in the central city when there's folks out in East Portland that don't have sidewalks. And it was relatively effective.
I could see where that would be a real divisive thing for somebody.
It did become divisive, right? I mean, it was perfect. It was just perfect for the papers. They ate it up.
Sure.
It was this, you know, anti-downtown central city getting everything versus, you know, out in East, and we're forgetting about East Portland. I don't know if the merits of DiZona's arguments were, you know, had, you know, that's
no.
For me, the whole point was that it came up. And it was a big deal.
It didn't work out so much for him.
Yeah, Sam ended up, you know, walking back from that project, partly, I think, because of that. It was a real effective argument. And again, it was a mayoral race. So Sam was more worried about becoming mayor, I think, sure, than getting that bridge project. But since then, it's become a huge, like, pillar of not just local transportation politics, but even on a national level in terms of talking about, you know, improvements to, like, sort of central core, or do you serve outlying areas? How do you deal with that balance in terms of investment and priority and stuff like that? And it's really a large issue here in Portland for a lot of factors, some that you mentioned at the top of the show. But, you know, we're a big city geographically. If you look at the size, a lot of people don't realize, but, you know, Portland goes out to 64? I mean, it's out there, you know? And that's a large city geographically. And I think we've added a lot of that relatively recently. And it's pretty clear that we haven't also added sort of political representation at the same time. Obviously, there's huge disparities in the way the land is used, in the zoning, and everything else that sort of follows into that, infrastructure being another one. So as we built out, like in my world, the thing I look at the most in terms of bikeways, bike network, as we've built that out, there's obviously much less of it out in East Portland. So it had become, you know, it's something we hear about so much in our regular beat, you know, doing Bike Portland. And I started to think that, you know, just to give myself a better understanding, and Michael Anderson, our news editor, a better understanding of what it's really like out there, because I personally don't spend much time out there, so I didn't feel like I could really report about it.
Much in the same way we were talking about earlier, how the people with the power are not really around the people who are being affected by these decisions.
Right, and there's one thing I've learned doing Bike Portland for these 9 years is that you know, putting out words and pictures every day, you just can't fake that. You have to really understand what it is that you're writing about in order to do it well. I mean, actually, you can fake it. People do. But I don't think that really does justice to a lot of the stuff and the way I like to cover things. So, you know, I thought it was really overdue. Anyway, just got this idea to go out to East Portland for the week and sort of set up shop out there.
Okay.
And just run the business from East Portland and see how that felt, see how that looked, see how it changed the stories that we'd cover and how we cover them and everything. And it turned out to be a really great experience.
I was going to say, what is the first, like, thing that struck you out there as you're setting up? And
well, one of the first things was one of the most important things that I even that I took away, which was, it takes a long time to get out there on a bike.
Yeah.
I mean, the sheer distance from the central city is a big thing, not just because it was inconvenient and I didn't like spending, you know, an extra 40 minutes getting to where I would work every day, but, you know, mentally, that's a big distance from downtown where the action happens in City Hall. And that's an important thing for how I think people that live out there view the lawmaking, the decision making, the policy making in the city.
And yeah, specifically when it comes to, like, biking out that way, this sort of speaks to something when we had Michael Tedda on about biking as a lifestyle or biking as a only mode of transportation, you know, only going by bike, being car free, is still in some way a position of privilege. And there's a lot of people who, you know, they have jobs, I don't know, say in Central City, but can only afford to live, like, out in Hillsborough. Well, that's not East, but out in Gresham or, you know, further out. And so having to bike out that far, you probably get more of a grasp of that distance.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you have to think, oh, there's this important project or this important committee I'm kind of thinking of getting involved in, and your calculation from inner southeast is, all right, it's going to be 15 minutes on my bike to cruise over to be at this meeting. Because let's face it, most of the big meetings and committees and city action is happening downtown, right? So if you're inner southeast, inner northeast, you hop on the bikeway, you're there in 15 minutes about on average. If you're living out in East Portland, east of 205 or east 82nd, that calculation is a lot different right off the top. You're all of a sudden going to have, you know, you could have close to 2 hours just if you're going to bike there, just in biking time. And that's a deal breaker, right? So you're not going to show up.
It can be.
Or, so, you know, fewer people show up, or the people that show up, it's always the same people, right? So you just don't have the mix of activism and which is really important, which are people important. That's one of the great things about this city is how many people are involved. But you can see as you get further out, you really can understand it sometimes just comes to these really practical reasons why there's not a lot of East Portland representation at City Hall, because it's freaking far. You know?
Yeah. And I mean, there's even sort of even smaller reasons, like, you know, it's a pretty hot day out there tonight, today. And you don't necessarily want to show up for a meeting all sweaty, even if you do have like a change of clothes. I mean, that's even more time that you got to build in.
Right.
That.
Planning and stuff like that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And again, that's something that you just may or may not have time or even the capacity of mind to do.
Yeah. I mean, you can understand too. I mean, one way I look at the different parts of the city, because I think it's kind of fascinating how people that live in different parts of Portland just view Portland, their experience of this city and their experience of let's say, what happens downtown or City Hall or anything like that. And I live in North Portland, and I actually think when I say view, I mean actually the view of downtown. So
physical view.
Yeah. And I think in some ways it might be what's informing and kind of like setting people up for their good or bad feelings, let's say. And this is all just generalized stuff by me.
Sure.
But in my case, my first view of downtown is usually from the Mississippi Hill, where I'm coming down Mississippi there.
Yeah.
And what's my view from North Portland? It's a huge, huge cloverleaf of freeway interchange ramps and massive freeway bridges and freeways in every direction. It's kind of like an ugly, ugly view from someone who doesn't like that kind of stuff.
Right, right. And in the mornings, it's all gridlock.
So, and I think that is, in some ways, actually a story of North Portland. I mean, there's a reason all that stuff is right there. And you can just look at the local history to understand that, you know, I-5 and all those things. So that's my view. And that's a lot of people in North Portland's view. They see all these highways and massive infrastructure. It's not human scaled. They can't connect to it. They can't relate to it. So let's go down and look at the view again from someone who lives in inner southeast or further southeast, you know, Sellwood or something.
Sure.
What's their view when they first see downtown?
Oh, I'm thinking Sellwood. You've got the Springwater Trail.
It's beautiful. There's the city skyline.
You've got Oaks Bottom on your way in.
Oh, the Blue Herons, which everybody likes to go on social media and tell you about. Oh, I saw ducklings crossing the bike path on my way. You right? So it's this like idyllic, beautiful thing, right? And so that's how those are the feelings that they kind of interact with.
Right, right.
In their terms of like,
and
what is
Portland? And they associate downtown as they're coming in.
Right. And I mean, you could kind of expand it. Southwest, well, they're up on a hill. So to them, coming downtown is, you know, that's down the hill. Their first look at it, they're actually, there's some similarities to East Portland because there's really not great connections from Southwest.
Sure.
And actually, if you talk to people in this transportation and bicycling beat, there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of folks in Southwest that are really upset that they've been left out. Yes, in terms of, having bikeways and stuff and good connections into downtown, stuff like that. But so just to kind of, you know, put an end to this sort of idea of the views people have on the city, well, what about folks in East Portland? They, if they have a view of the city, which they probably don't, first of all.
No, as somebody who lives east of 82nd.
Yeah, how often do you get to lay your eyes on the city on a sort of weekly basis?
If I happen to be up Mount Tabor at that right time, you know.
In that case, it probably looks really good. But.
No, it does, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I'm lucky enough to live not very far from Mount Tabor, but...
But there's a disconnect, right? I mean, so you're
Totally.
You don't actually see it.
And, you know, again, like you have to climb to look at the city from where I'm at. If I were just to look west towards the city, what do I see? I see car lots. I see, you know, well, the mountain. I see highway.
Right. So I think if you understand that's how people have this view of their physical and sort of mental map of the city, it can kind of help explain these differences of where people come from and how they feel like they can be a part or not of what's happening in the city.
Right. And the placement of 205, I think, was really, it speaks a lot to that, you know. Right. Not only did it really divide that part of East Portland, but then again, you know, I think it speaks to a certain, or informs a certain mentality of like, well, we're Portland, but we're not really Portland.
Right.
We're the forgotten right. side of this.
Yeah, a freeway that can be a perfectly powerful thing to do that. You know, it's the other side
yeah.
of the freeway. And it really is, you know, being out there for the week, it's not the Portland that you see, you know, down here, obviously. I mean, that's not news to anybody. But, you know, it's a different thing. It was a big eye-opener for me, compared to going out there for a meeting here and there or an event here or there, which I certainly did every once in a while.
Sure.
It was different to try to set up shop there and to know that I was going to be there every morning and just work there. I mean, so we actually did our East Portland Week, we called it, right as Pedalpalooza got started, which is this big event every June.
Oh, we talk about Pedalpalooza.
3 weeks or so of great bike events. And Michael and I had this conversation of like, you know, oh, shoot, it's going to be Pedalpalooza. Maybe it's not the best week for East Portland Week. And then I'm thinking, well, that's actually the whole entire point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So
it's a perfect
it's the perfect thing, right? Because that's, if you live out there, you don't just get to choose, oh, I'm not going to live out here because it's Pedalpalooza week. No, like, so that was the thing. I was like, no, actually, we have to go out there. Even if it makes Pedalpalooza more difficult for us to participate in, that's the whole point, is to feel what it's like to not get to sort of play the reindeer games, right?
Good point.
I mean, like,
yeah.
So that's the thing. So there we were, scanning the Pedalpalooza calendar for stuff that would kind of like be a little closer to where we'd set up shop. We worked mostly around Gleason and 102nd.
Okay.
A Starbucks that was there.
Sure.
We ended up working out there for the most of the time. So there we were, you know, scanning through the Pedalpalooza calendar, trying to find stuff we could do. There was a Rocky Butte dance party that ended up lining up.
Which still goes on.
Able to go to.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one just last Thursday. Was it?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. But it wasn't as easy as being downtown and just, I mean, I could, from my office downtown to North Portland, I could have seen two or three rides on my way home, you know, would have been super easy. But that was a neat part of the experience, is to think, well, you know, and for the people that live out there, they're all these bike fun events and all these things that are going on, they just kind of, either they're putting a lot of miles in or they're just not taking part. And that has a real consequence of
sure.
them just being left out.
I think, again, going back to the view being a way that informs, you know, people's perspective of what is or is not Portland or their experience of Portland. I think the distance from events like bike fun events, and not just bike fun events, but other things in and around the city, especially inner southeast, at least that's where my, you know, experience is. The people who are outside of that, it informs this sort of divisive form of opinions. Like, I can think of, you know, I don't mean to pick on Milwaukee, but I can think of Milwaukee when the decision was whether or not to incorporate with Portland. There was a lot of sort of pushback, like, we are not Portland,
right?
You know, and then there was, and I can't remember, this was a couple years ago now, another town that had incorporated and then was trying to vote against, or trying to vote to disincorporate.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's just all these signs of like, we are not Portland. Right. We are not that, you know, bike fun weirdo right. community. We're right. just a farm community. You know, we go into Portland when we need to, mm-hmm. but we are not.
And I think for some towns, that's an easier conversation because they can hang their hat on something and identify and say, well, we're from Milwaukee, or we're Damascus. We're whatever town, because there's an identity. I think, you know, in the case of East Portland, because of the way it's been developed, you know, it has a harder time, I think, finding its identity and sort of creating that pride in some regard. I mean, it's really been, you know, it's the way it's built up and the kind of businesses. I mean, 82nd's a perfect example, but even beyond that, these are not the type of spaces that people really identify with in general, you know?
Well, and you talk about human scale. These are
right.
not
right.
human spaces.
Lots, you know, huge, you know, big box shopping centers and block after block of sort of, everything. I mean, that was one of the things I took away is I could take pictures. I almost did kind of a story about this, but I could take a photo of a street and I was going to be like, can you tell where this is? And the whole point was going to be no, because so many of these streets look exactly the same. You've got this huge wide expanse of, you know, 3-4 lanes on each side, really large capacity roadways, and just all, you know, just crisscrossing a lot of East Portland, and it kind of all looks the same. So, you know, I think in order, that's another thing. I think it makes it hard for really strong sort of culture of activism to happen, is that there's this, what's the identity? What are you when you're from? And East Portland's a big place. We use that just as a convenient term, but like, you know, sure. We don't say, if you compare what I'm probably meaning when I say that for East Portland to compare it in size to, you know, the way we define neighborhoods here in inner Portland, where it's a bike, you know, block by block almost, we have your own, a different name of a neighborhood, you know?
Yeah, if you took like what we define as East Portland and like brought it further west, like sort of superimposed one on the other, it would like take up all these other neighborhoods.
Right.
That are around, you know?
Right. And it's not to say that all of East Portland, it's a much more complicated, interesting, and multi-layered place than I think a lot of folks that, you know, commentate and want to do punditry about it, or politicians really even understand, because they're not out there enough. Within East Portland, there's really great examples of amazing citizen activism going on, and people making real change and exciting things, and some really, really strong identities in some neighborhoods, you know. So there's pockets of it that are really awesome and actually would remind you of, you know, some of the inner neighborhoods. I mean, if you look at actual spending, which is, I think, an interesting part of this whole East Portland conversation, like the newer version of it versus when it kind of started in 2008 in terms of being a big issue, the later story, the more recent story, is the fact that they've actually, in terms of active transportation infrastructure, East Portland has far outpaced the central city.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of spending.
Really?
And that's because, yeah, absolutely. I mean, millions and millions of dollars have been spent, federal grants, state grants, local grants. And that's because it got so bad and it got to be such a political term, and it became so much pressure built up. Partly, like I said, it started in this mayoral campaign. So anything that has the power to influence a mayoral campaign in terms of politics as an issue,
sure,
those are really powerful things. And if you're a smart activist, you'll cling to that and realize that's how you make.
Like, I can use this to make some
exactly
change happen.
That's how you make hay. And people did. And there's some really smart, really great people out there. You know, like we did our Friday profile during East Portland Week. That's a regular series that we do.
Yeah.
Michael interviewed Jim Chassie, who's just this great activist out there. And he's been, you know, all the way from just street level stuff to, I mean, he was on the advisory committee for the bike master plan. He was like an official East Portland rep. Okay. So this guy has done a lot of work. And, you know, he was one of the people that created this thing, East Portland in Motion. You might've heard of this major city plan, our East Portland Action Plan. So they got together, a group of citizen activists and advocates, and they had sort of been like, enough's enough. You know, East Portland's getting ignored. We need to come together and make some change. And they've been really successful in seeing, that's how things get done in Portland. You identify a bunch of projects and needs, and then you start to advocate for it. You put it into a plan, because City Hall doesn't want to hear from you unless you have something in a plan. That's just how Portland works. It's a planning city. And they did that. They created a plan. They bolted that plan onto the bike master plan.
Okay.
And part of it, and whatever plan they could bolt it to, they would. They basically would. And they'd formed such a powerful block that they could tell the city, you can't get East Portland support for X, Y, or Z plan unless you allow us to bolt on our stuff.
Okay.
Right?
Nice.
And basically the city said, sure, fine. Nice work on that plan. It's now, you know, it's now a piece of this other big plan we just adopted, which means once you have adopted plans, then you can actually get federal money, state money to come down. And they've been real successful doing that. I mean, the other thing is they've unfortunately had to pay a high price in a human cost way, because people die in East Portland on those roads. And that's a sad reality, is that if there's one thing that gets City Hall to act and get purse strings to open in Portland, it's when people lose their life on the road. And that's been part of the East Portland story in terms of them getting a lot of money in grants and such and funding, is that they've unfortunately had some really tragic collisions out there, mostly on the walking side of things, where people trying to cross the street. The roads are just so fast and so wide.
Sure.
it's way too easy to have those kind of things happen. So, you know, that one situation, that young girl, I think it was like 120th or so. Anyway, so that brought, you know, a state representative, press conference, urgent need. And then you fast forward a couple months after that, and well, there's your $1.6 million thing, and there's your new sidewalks, you know. So they got a lot from that.
Right on. This reminds me of what was once called the Holgate Raceway.
Oh, right.
Speaking of East Portland, the Holgate is a street that stretches from east to west. But east of, like, say, 92nd, it was at one point four lanes.
Yeah.
And then was reduced to two lanes and bike lanes on each side. Yeah.
Yeah, big, nice, buffered ones.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad to see that. There's a part of me that's like, why is that not in the central city as oh, well?
Yeah. You know. You mean that kind of, that nice bike way?
Yeah. Yeah.
See,
yeah.
There you go. There's some nice stuff out in this part. Well, they have a lot of capacity on the roads, which we struggle here is that we're always trying to put a lot of stuff into narrow width. But out there, it's one reason I tell, you know, in Washington County, I mean, people can get really depressed about how far they have to come and it's so auto-centric. But I'm always saying, actually, given all the room that you've got in this road, you could do amazing things like overnight if you had the will to do them.
Right.
And, you know, Holgate was a pretty clear example of that. Although, you know, Holgate was such an interesting illustration of a lot of these issues, the way it went down and the way
it became pretty divisive at the time, didn't it?
Yeah, it became a super big controversy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, come to find out, like a lot of these controversies that happen when there's a bicycle-related thing involved, there's a lot of emotions that come up from neighborhoods. And I think a lot of times it has to do with things that have nothing to do with bicycles or a bicycle lane. Absolutely not. And I think Holgate was, you know, a perfect example. I think Williams was also an example of that. When people have grievances with the city for long overdue things that are unfixed and unsettled. And
Williams, I think when you bring that up, that is a great example.
Yeah, these are it's open
been ignored
wounds
for so long.
Absolutely, and the city just kicks. They just never deal with it. The core, you know, misgivings that people have. I mean, that's putting it lightly. I mean, real anger that sort of just swept under a rug until, you know, because you could do
it. And then here comes the city putting this bike-only
And it's,
lane in here.
Exactly. And so because also there's another layer of that in American culture in general, hating on bicycling is totally accepted.
Because we're an auto culture.
We're an auto culture. Exactly. And that is such a powerful and pervasive sort of paradigm of America, you know, our love of cars and all these things, right? And in popular culture, in the media, everything, making fun of people that are on bikes or people that love bikes is an accepted part of our culture, right? So you mix that with going into neighborhoods where the city has a lot of undone work in terms of healing relationships with citizens, and you get this perfect storm. And that's especially a city that is doing things that are kind of new. So you add in, this is not just some 5-foot bike lane. In both these situations, Holgate and Williams, the city was looking to really change how people experience that street. So you got this, I mean, think about it, change, past wounds that are open, still unhealed, you know? And it's a perfect storm for, you know, and Holgate was, I covered the Holgate thing really closely because it was fascinating. And I remember going to, the city had to go have an extra meeting. I mean, when the city has to call a special meeting to sort of tamp down, you know, tempers, you know that they're scared, that they're afraid that they need to make this go away. It's really interesting, you know? So that's what they had.
Williams happened with, and then Williams and then 28th.
Right. So anytime you see like a special meeting that wasn't on the initial schedule, that's like a huge red flag, obviously. Those are like, oh shit meetings. Like, wow, we better nip this in the bud. Mm-hmm. And they threw everything they could at Holgate, and they knew that they had a tinderbox because, I mean, the East Portland history is well known, you know? Those people didn't necessarily vote to be annexed in, and obviously, you know, the city's not putting a lot of money out in those neighborhoods like they are in the central city. You know, there's all this past stuff. And so when I went to cover that story, I mean, my basic frame on this stuff is that bicycling is a great thing. It's inherently good.
Yeah.
I don't think I could sit down with any person of reasonable, sound mind and have a discussion and have them not leave under, you know, agreeing that bicycling is basically a good thing, right? there's a lot of details and sort of optics that change the nature of the discussion, but ultimately bikes are a good thing. So that's why I'm always interested to go cover these things. And I remember going to that meeting on Holgate, which was essentially a meeting to like calm everybody down. And it was in a church, and it was packed with people, and they were super angry. You could just feel it. It's like crackling, you know, before the lightning or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just like,
the electricity is in the air.
And the other big sign is like, and I've seen so many of these things with the city. They brought in someone not from the city to mediate, to like be one of the spokespeople. It's another classic move, because then you've taken
away.
You got
someone who doesn't really have a horse in the race.
Exactly. It's not a city person, so they can't be the brunt of as much anger because they're kind of this third party thing. The city person stands behind and gets ready to answer detailed questions, but it's sort of this mediator figure. But I was proud. I was pretty pleased to see the city brought their best people, really smart people. They had a whole presentation that showed, you know, why it was necessary, how it's been a good thing. So that was what it was. People were angry, and there was this back and forth. But I went. People started getting up and leaving. They were so angry.
Oh, wow.
Because it was clear the city wasn't going to take it out. I mean, that would have been – I mean, it's Portland. They're not going to take out a bike lane they put in. That's just not going to happen.
Right.
First of all, because they're not stupid enough to put one in a place that's just not the right place. We have pretty smart people working at the city. So people were getting up and leaving, and they'd yell, and then they – you know, there's one guy, I'll never forget, got up and – He gets up and leaves after yelling out a turn and being really rude, and his shirt in big letters says, "Sam is not my mayor."
Oh, wow.
You know, so and this was a time. And this was kind of when the scandal with Sam was still, I think, around.
Okay. Still a little fresh.
A little bit fresh, if I recall. And so that was kind of like this thing that clicked for me. It's like, obviously, there's a lot of anger in this room about Sam Adams.
Sure.
Think about who he is in terms of like his political outlook, and think about the political outlook of folks that live on Holgate.
Right.
And other things, you know, the whole "we're not Portland" thing is, you know, "we're not downtown" is strong there. And you have this mayor, Sam, who is totally embracing that, right? So there was a big clash of perspectives. And this guy who's, you know, "Sam's not my mayor" on his shirt. And I'm like, dude, we're here talking about a bike lane.
Right.
What is Sam at? Like, so I followed that guy out and started talking to him, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was really interesting.
Really?
And I proceeded to talk to every person that left the meeting, all upset at what you'd think if you were there. Maybe you'd... If you were just reporting and you didn't maybe think about it too much, you may think, oh, those people are really pissed off at this bike lane. That certainly is that's the perspective that the local media...
Well, if you don't ask the question,
right.
Sure.
Right, or if you want to gin up this divisiveness, which a lot of local media does, and they certainly did on Holgate. And actually the interesting thing is the reason that meeting was packed and people were angry was even more so not because of the bike lane. It was because of this story that was on K2 called "Bike Lanes to Nowhere." It was this K2 On Your Side exclusive... Coming up at 6, they had one of the reporters sitting in a lawn chair in the new buffered bike lanes on Holgate, looking at his watch with like a hands of a clock spinning behind him and a graphic. I mean, it was so poor and sensational. Like, oh, the city, without telling anybody, put this buffered bike in.
Yeah. Not necessarily the most objective of journalism.
Oh, they talked to the local guy who works in an auto service shop, and he was just railing against it. And it was all this, you know, totally.
Because he works in an auto service shop.
Right. And the guy sitting in a lawn chair in the bike lane, I was like, they didn't just do that, did they? That is just not fair. I mean, so that's, you know, then they have this meeting. And so obviously a lot of people were pissed. They saw that. So when I start talking to people as they leave, of course, after a few minutes, we're nodding, we're totally, everything's fine. It's not about the bike. Mm-hmm. People are telling me about this one time when the city came and cut their tree down and they weren't supposed to. And the guy was super pissed about that. I'm like, sure. You know, they're getting all these grievances off their chest. And this really sensational story had popped up, and it was showed the city made this mistake, right? So what do you do if you're angry and you see someone that's kind of like maybe vulnerable because they messed up? You're going to go for the throat.
Right.
And that's right. a lot of what this stuff is.
Well, and the bike lane sort of symbolizes like all of the lack of choice that they had felt that they had at that time.
And unfortunately, in this case, the city did mess up. I don't recall if they admitted it, but they really screwed up the outreach on that one on Holgate. They didn't warn them that soon. I think they sent the postcards out like on a weekend. And then it was like striped by like Tuesday or something. So that was, and I heard that from people in City Hall that's actually, they actually did mess up. So that doesn't help, you know? And so people were rightfully angry. And like I said, all this perfect storm, but you know, it was heartening for me to talk to people and realize, I remember talking to one guy, I'm like, so, you know, how could you be, the fact that this is going to be a lot safer for some people to use this road.
Sure.
I mean, certainly you don't want to be in a position where you know, you're going to be involved with a collision with someone riding a bike. Oh, no, no, bikes are fine. That's no problem, you know. So it's really isn't about the bike lane.
It's the principle.
Exactly, right. So that shows a lot of, I think, what happens in esport. And in part of our eSportland Week coverage, we went back and I had Michael go out and talk to people on Holgate to kind of check up on it.
Oh, really?
And
sort of the long-term effects of what has gone on.
Yeah, and we specifically decided to go back and talk to that auto shop owner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he talked to Michael, gave him some comments and everything. And just like we would have expected, it's fine.
Yeah.
Nobody has a problem with it.
No one really.
No. Because, you know, yeah. And there's plenty of people that we talked to in that story that literally changed their life in terms of their access to the community, their experience, you know, being able to ride a bike and cross that street and use that street, and just glowing reviews from people that want to use it.
This speaks to something that is kind of pretty prevalent in journalism in general, is the sensationalism of emotion. Especially, mm-hmm. like it's an easy thing to hang your writing on, I think, as a journalist. Yeah. You know, you went so far as to talk to these people who walked out of the meeting, whereas I could see somebody, especially if you've got a looming deadline or if you're just kind of hanging out, taking notes as you observe things, you know, you see someone leave, rather than investigating their reasons for leaving, you just, you know, write in your note, you know, Joe Schmo left, he was pissed, says Sam's not my mayor.
Right.
You know. Yeah. I think it was Dan Christensen. You know, he has his TriMet blog there. I don't know if it's still going on. He did a really interesting thing back when the whole sort of scandal of the $100,000 a year drivers was coming out on the Oregonian.
Oh, right, right.
And arguing, like, you know, you can talk about facts or you can talk about emotions. And you know, the Oregonian in general, they can do some really good jobs, but I think sometimes when they drop the ball, they really drop the ball. And this was, I think, a piece in which they went a little far on the emotion side of things, and it got a lot of other emotions of,
right,
you know, people who you know, these are my taxes that are going to these drivers, and you know, they're hiking the rates even more, and yet this driver gets $100,000 a year.
Yeah,
you got the emotion and the facts, and
it's a classic tactic of media outlets, newspapers, TV, where they do a piece that's so sensational and divisive. I mean, it's framed in a way that's purely black, white, us, them. That's what they do.
It's an easy thing to do.
It's easy. It's so, very easy, and it works from a click. And most of the time it gets you a lot of traffic, but it's diminishing returns, in my opinion. But what happens is that this is what they do. They do those kind of stories, and then they elicit a huge response, you know, mostly full of emotion, mostly, you know, a lot of it really upset, right?
Right.
And then they justify the first story by saying, well, look at all these this is really an issue that people want to...
positive feedback loop.
Yeah, they're like, oh, but everybody... But Jonathan, don't criticize, because... Boy, it's clear everybody wants to talk about this, and there's some real feelings on each side, don't you think? And we've brought this conversation up. We know that you didn't want to hear it, but, you know, because it doesn't say great things about biking, but these are really important. This is what our readers want to know about. I'm thinking, you don't have a right to stir the pot of the soup that you add the ingredients to. Like, that's how I look at it. Like,
sure.
It's not our job to be adding ingredients into the soup, right? It's our job to, like, just say how it tastes and, you know, that kind of thing, who made it. But you don't – too many of these other places, I think – will add their own little things in, and then they report about how it tastes after they've added. You know what I mean?
You
can't do that. That's not how it works. And so it's a real pet peeve of mine, because I think it has actual real severe and real tangible consequences on sort of the civic dialogue, which is, I think, really important to making a city that works well, you know, for everyone, is one where we can talk about actual issues and policies and have discussions without being a fight. In having a winner and a loser, because as soon as you start fighting, you're not talking about the issue.
It becomes something entirely different.
Most of the time it becomes more emotional. It becomes, you know, and sometimes there's a reason for emotion, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for, you know, heated back and forth. But I think, I mean, just like in our national dialogue, it's a similar phenomenon where it's 99.9% yelling and screaming and who looks stronger and better.
Whose kung fu is the best.
Yeah, who's going to win the argument versus like, wait, what are we arguing about again? This is actually pretty important. And all the time we spend yelling at each other, we're not actually, you know, fixing. So that's kind of my new, that's my thing is that like my goal is to try to get it so that on whatever issue it is, we can go for as long of a time as possible actually having a good discussion with all these different viewpoints, whether they bike or like, you know, whether they have the same opinion that, you know, what you might think a bike advocate has or whatever, that's how you actually make progress. Because you let the arguments reach their conclusion.
Sure.
Right? You can't have a good debate unless an argument can get all the way to the end, I don't think. And what happens is they get derailed by people yelling and screaming at each other. So you never get to hear the end. And like I said before... like I said before, in my mind, when the argument around cycling is allowed to reach its reasonable conclusion... And it can be heard out in a constructive, reasonable way. It's you can't beat that argument. It's such a great thing, inherently that if it's heard and can be heard in a calm way, people will support it. That's what I believe.
That would be a great soundbite to end this on. But I want to ask you about one more thing.
Sure, sure.
The 50s bikeways. Mm. This is somewhat related, but this just came through, and so I think it's worth talking about here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was something that was pretty contested for a real long time. I remember there was some argument about losing the parking, the access to parking on those roads. I don't know how a lot of people honestly are kind of like, in a way, crediting you for this, like,
oh, which part, the argument part,
or the pushing them through? I know, like,
I mean, those projects are so long and long term. They I mean, I think that's another one of those ones where I think if you read some of our headlines, I'm kind of like, I'm not gonna like openly make fun of it, but I will definitely make a point to point out that it's been like, you know what, 13 years since this project was first discussed. It's like, come on, folks, we're just trying to make a quick little update here. It shouldn't be long, a decade long. I mean, if we're building a train from here to Salem, then that's one thing.
And
you
that's
know,
that, 13 that,
you need a 13, but we're striping some bike lanes, like, you know, in a couple miles. So those things take so long, and I think in the 50s, there was there's not a lot of real significant bike infrastructure necessarily in that, you know, a lot of it's like sort of neighborhood greenway stuff where they basically taken a low volume residential street and made it a little nicer for bicycling and sort of added some signs to help you find your way.
And or speed bumps.
Yeah. And speed bumps and lower, you know, 20 mile hour speed limits. And then there was some significant, I think, change of how parking happens on the street. You know, they did reallocate some of that space in order to make bike lanes in some sections. But nothing major, I don't think, and the parking thing never really boiled up. I think the thing that really boiled up on that project, there's a few things, but one of them was diverted auto traffic. So if you make a neighborhood greenway and it's a bicycle way, and then and if you add any diversion, which I don't really think they did, but they did cut off some turning movements, I think.
Okay.
So that then you had neighbors on adjacent streets saying, okay, we don't like this because now the cars are going to come up our street. And that's a constant sort of controversy that's always stirring with the city is like, how do they decide how and when to do diversion and what do you do with the extra cars? And we could do a whole different show on that. But, but the other thing in the 50s is like how it connects to like Foster.
You know, right.
That was an interesting thing that came up with this other project, the Foster Street.
That was really surprising when I found out that Foster was getting bike lanes in it. Because, you know, I used to live down 92nd Foster area. And that was like no bikes.
Yeah. Well,
you
know,
you're taking your life in your own hands if you go down Foster.
Right. So you would know, I think most normal, reasonable people would think, oh, you're doing a bikeway project on 52nd and you're doing one on Foster. You're putting bike stuff on both of those. Oh, cool. So I'll be able to take 52nd to Foster and hang a left on the bike lane. But that's not exactly what you can do because, you know, unfortunately, the city just didn't quite have the sort of intestinal fortitude to make both those bikeways connect in the most sort of reasonable, obvious way. And I think anybody you talk to that understands planning or just common sense would be able to tell you that it needs to be as drop dead simple as possible to navigate around with your vehicle. I mean, if you're in a car, right, you don't you don't make little cut-throughs here and there to like get to your major. Sure. You just go here.
You don't
go
turn right to turn left.
Yeah, you do your left. So unfortunately in the 50s, you know, there's a little bit of zigzagging that has to happen because the city didn't want to continue a bike lane on Foster all the way to 52nd. And I've actually gotten a barrage of emails since because the 50s are striped. So those bike lanes are in.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so one thing I've heard is that there's a lot of bike lane parking going on by this real popular restaurant that serves Sunday brunch.
Yes.
I think it's just north of Foster, maybe.
Toast. Yeah.
I'm getting a lot of emails about that, so I've got to go out and investigate.
Yeah, I've heard that they've pulled out because they used to have a lot of bike staples that were in the parking strip, or what would be considered the parking strip for them.
Right.
I was never out there to confirm this myself either, but that they had pulled them out. I don't know what their point of view, what the people of Toast, if anybody from Toast is listening, which I doubt you are, I'd love to hear from you. But I don't know what their point of view was, whether or not this became kind of a divisive thing because, you know, again, having lived down 92nd mm-hmm. Foster, I would get out there occasionally and I loved being out there mm-hmm. Just because it seemed so bike friendly of a place. You know, you got all these staples where you could put one car, mm-hmm. you've got six staples.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I've got to go take a closer look at that. I know one thing the city does that really bothers me when they stripe new bikeways is they don't put enough signage to market that it's a bike lane. Mm. And that just invites. And the other thing is that they're making the bike lanes a little bit wider, which is great. Like they're doing them 7 feet, 8 feet when they can, at least 6 feet for the most part. So what it looks even more like a parking lane for cars. You know, so you see people parking up in sure. these bike lanes, and there's no bike symbol. There's
division in 87 was classic when they first put that that light in. Mm-hmm. You know, as a special light. For the bikes to cross. When they first put that in, and I don't know if police had decided to enforce this, but there was a lot of people parking. There's a bakery on one side and a restaurant on the other, and so there was a lot of people parking in those bike lanes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And again, like you were saying, they're not necessarily symboled and they're wide.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite as wide as a car would be, but yeah, in the meantime people just park there.
Yeah, park right in there. This is actually an interesting thing to sort of end on, because the fact that I haven't gotten out to 52nd to check on this, and I've gotten several emails about it, it sort of speaks to how this East Portland thing plays out in terms of scope and geography, because in my little world that I can have a little impact on or not, I tend to cover things that I can get to quickly way more than other things. That's a real constraint of my work.
Sure.
So if it's between my house and my office, man, I am on it. And I'm going to have photographs. I'm going to know exactly what's going on. I mean, that's why Williams,
you just need to buy you a new house.
Yeah, right. I think, I don't know, I've probably written 60-some articles on the Williams Project, right? Because it's in my backyard. But like the 50s, you're not going to see quite as much coverage because I'm just not there, you know. So that's pretty far south.
That's
a part of it.
Like Toast is Steele and 52nd.
Right,
that's pretty far.
But you know, and that's just funny. So we're going to be launching a subscriber program. So I'm going to hope everybody can sign up and be a subscriber, and then we can have maybe more writers or pay people to go out and be eyes and ears.
That would
more.
Be cool.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Sort of expanding the scope of
absolutely
of bike Portland.
Well, everybody that loves having Michael Anderson on staff, that's we could find other people. Probably not. We probably won't find anybody else as good as Michael, but we're going to try.
Not until cloning technology advances.
No. But I'd love to have Stringer contributors out, you know, in different parts of the city that can say, hey, go out to Toast. What's going on? You know, and then they can get paid for that. That's the idea. So
that's great. Yeah, that is a perfect one to end on, I think.
Yeah, right.
All right, Mr. Mouse, thank you for joining us. And I should call you Jonathan, shouldn't I?
No,
you just
fine.
Gave me this funny look. What, mister?
Hey, I'm only 30. I'm not 40 yet. So,
oh, there you go.
No, it's good being here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Hey, it's Brock.
Hi, it's Adele.
And we are sitting outdoors on a picnic table.
In the middle of Okanagan country.
Yes. And there have been peals of thunder. There's one now.
You don't hear this in Portland, so it's really exciting, and we are also very easily entertained.
Right. We have the fly set up on the tent just in case it gets wet, but it hasn't actually started raining yet.
Brock's been learning how to purify water with this Terry pen, which he doesn't really trust, but...
Well, it's not that I don't trust it. I don't know how to use it. Thank you, Lance, for letting us borrow it. I just need to look up the directions online.
But you're immune now to unpurified water because you chugged 12 ounces of it from straight up from, like, this mud... It wasn't a muddy river, but it was a river.
Yeah, it was very swiftly moving river.
Yeah, water. down from a dam and, like, lots of cattle ground. And,
there was no potable water there. And I said, hey, I am very thirsty. I'm just going to drink this. I think I did it almost before I thought about it.
So I was probably the maddest I've ever been at you on this, certainly on this trip, if not ever, because I could just see you jeopardizing our entire journey by getting terrible dysentery. Or
explosive diarrhea, yes.
And
it didn't happen.
We were not close to any amenities, so I was like coming up with all these contingency plans, and then I was making myself feel sick because I ate some berries that I hadn't identified just because for the hell of it. But we're both okay.
We're living on the edge.
But so we just purify water now just as a...
Yes.
Well, we don't need to.
I have iodine.
Seems like a good idea.
Which will be completely worked through the water bottle in 20 minutes. Right next to me. Mm. So we were at Glacier National Park.
Last time we updated.
Yeah. And we had a fantastic trip there. We took the shuttle up to the top of Going to the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Saw Logan Pass. It was all amazingly beautiful.
Saw a couple of Rocky Mountain goats.
Mm, yes.
And their kids and nanny goats. That was exciting.
Yeah.
And some glaciers.
And
they move fast. We watched the glaciers go by.
We watched them proceed past us.
They go by at noon every day. We watched them.
So after Glacier, we headed west, and we made our way. I'm trying to remember the highlights of our trip from there. I know we were leaving Montana, so we were in Montana for another day or two.
Mm-hmm.
We had some fabulous camping at Dickey Lake, because the sun was hot and the lake was there.
Mm-hmm.
And our camp host, Fred, was incredibly friendly. And that was a beautiful place. We went, where'd we go after that?
Hmm.
We went through the woods mostly.
It's all kind of a blur.
Yeah.
And
well,
I
we
read
ended
through
up,
it in my mind.
Yeah.
Okay, where did we go?
After
we ended
Dickey
up
Lake.
By a river for free,
mm-hmm.
right?
It was an Army Corps of Engineers site.
We took a really beautiful, quiet Forest Service road up through kind of ranch country, through the woods. And then we ended up at that river. Below that dam.
Yes.
Where you drank the water.
That one in Montana.
Yeah, Army Corps of Engineers, free camping.
Yeah.
Fist bump.
Totally.
Yeah.
We met Tom from Philadelphia and Claudia, and Tom wandered into our campsite without a shirt and commented on the fishing conditions.
Yeah, he freaked me out because I was just like reading, and I look over and there's this like kind of grizzled shirtless man like stalking toward me. And I was like, oh, hi. And I quickly edged over to you like, this is Brock. And
he'll
he
protect
was
me.
Just like, I didn't get much luck fishing today. Actually, he didn't talk like that. He talked like Rocky. So then the first time, then he left.
You guys want a couple of beers?
Yeah.
Well,
not even
no.
that. And
no.
you were like, I think he's from the East Coast. And I was like, oh my God, he is from Pennsylvania all the way. Like,
right.
I know it. And sure enough, he returned an hour later wearing a Steelers sweatshirt.
Right, right.
So he was just Pittsburgh through and through.
Totally.
Hilarious.
But the nicest old curmudgeon you could possibly hope to meet out in the middle of Montana. For a guy who works as a laborer for the Public Works Division of Pittsburgh, he loves the outdoors, and I think he gets into it as much as he can. So we spent the evening talking to he and his lady friend, and we had some beers, and it was lovely.
And pretzels, which is also
and
very
pretzels.
Pennsylvanian, Snyder's pretzels.
Mm. Yeah, so much so that they tipped us off to the location of the waterfall featured in the River Wild.
Yes, which Brock's never seen.
But, I have not seen
this. You know, Meryl Streep is a badass and my hero, and so I was so excited to go down to these falls, which is where the showdown was filmed at the end. And there's like, I don't know if the hanging rope bridge is in the movie, but it was like exactly like in the movie. And I was just, oh, that was a highlight.
They tipped us off to that. And they met us on our way south as we were going through the Cabinet Mountain, or we were below the Cabinet Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And they met us and gave us Diet Coke and bologna and cheese and
yes.
mustard. So
they counteracted your misanthropic tendencies.
Right, right.
Because other times over the trip, you have bemoaned the fact that you're becoming a misanthrope.
Kind of, yeah. I feel like, I don't know exactly what it is. There's something about the difference between me being an urban dweller and not my distrust, but my, it's like I'm not very familiar with the rural context. So it's always interesting, and I think I have a lot of assumptions that I'm still trying to break free of.
Yeah, it's a totally different culture than what we're used to.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's heard a lot of Portlanders are in a bubble, and we kind of are. I mean, I didn't grow up in Portland, so I feel like I can relate to a pretty broad spectrum of people, but mm-hmm. it's still a lot different. And mostly we come up with really nice people.
Generally.
Yeah. Should we tell them about Idaho?
Well, we went to Idaho.
For another day.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time near dams and in Army Corps of Engineer sites because they build a lot of campgrounds after they build dams.
Yeah, and Idaho abounds in free camping.
Yeah, it was right above the Albany Dam in Idaho that on the Pondere River. Priest River was the town, and the Priest River and the Pondere flow together at this campground. Beautiful bicycle camping spot. But that was after Sandpoint where we met the guy on the motorcycle.
Yeah. So this was funny. Basically I'd heard from some people in Portland, oh, like Matt Piccio's tactic. Oh, I'm going to bike tour in a rural area. I know I'll put an American flag on the back of my bike and everyone will like love me. So you found an American flag on the 5th of July on the road.
Yeah, I hadn't flown it yet.
So I was like, Brock, we're going through Sandpoint, Idaho, like this place of, you know, white people and they're, I don't know.
There's a lot of white people there.
Yeah. They're excited about, I assume they'd be excited about being American and about seeing someone with an American flag on their bike. So I was like, Brock, give me the flag. I'm going to put it on the back of my bike. So
here's
like
my social
display
experiment.
Display it, you know, and I'm flying it and I'm like, oh, I'm just going to look forward to everyone waving and honking at me as I bike into Sandpoint triumphantly
so well
with
received.
My flag. Everyone will love me. And I didn't get any, like, unnatural attention, bad or good or otherwise. Like, no waves, no honks or whatever. And so then we roll into town, and I feel kind of funny with this American flag on the back of my bike because I don't really do this. And we go to the big Safeway in Sandpoint, and we're just hanging out, like, eating our potato salad in front of Safeway, and this, like, kind of doughy guy on a motorcycle comes up, and he says, oh, you better be careful with that flag. You might offend someone around here. And I was like, oh, I'm just trying to make friends. And he's like, oh, well, they beat up a Marine for being nice to Muslims, so you got to watch out. And I was like, come again? Like, I have no idea how this makes sense.
Well, he was the stereotype of a very right-wing Republican Idaho dweller, I think, that I've been trying to disavow myself from, because not everyone that lives in Idaho behaves in that way. But he went from American flags to the terrorists to, I'd like to see them try and do something to me. I've got a gun.
Oh, and to burkas.
Yeah.
Don't forget that.
Yeah. In less than 5 minutes.
And
so.
I like really genuinely wanted to figure out like why I shouldn't fly an American flag. So I was like asking him, I was like, why shouldn't I do this? And he just completely like disregarded that and just went on into this complete non sequitur of like burkas. Which
it was kind of unspooling
pretty,
his thoughts.
You
yeah.
know, in retrospect, is pretty funny. So now we have a lot more fodder for jokes of like, oh, look out, you might offend someone.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's you know who likes to eat chili? The terrorists.
They beat up a Marine for riding a bike the other week. You better
be
careful.
I'd like to see them take my chili away. I've got a gun. So, anyways, all that to say that we've had varied experiences, but by and large, many of the people we've met have been very nice.
And to wrap up with the American flag later that day, I got a flat. I had fixed it. It was probably 95 degrees out. My hands were covered in grease. I was trying to pull the pump off of the valve after inflating the tire. I gouged my knuckle on one of the teeth rings of my back chain ring and start just... Oh, so mad. The first thing I grab is the American flag, and I just start, like, sopping up my bleeding, greasy finger with this flag. I almost threw it on the ground and stomped on it. But then I think you ended up throwing away the flag. So.
Well, I won't say that.
Oh.
But
don't let the Idahoans know that you threw away a flag.
But there was a flag that had been dishonored, and so it had to be properly, you know, it could not be displayed in that state.
It was used for triage.
So... Anyways,
that was a good story.
You know.
Yeah.
Happy America, everybody. We crossed back into Washington State. We stayed last night in Republic. We had beer at the Republic Brewing Company.
Stoked, not gonna lie, man.
Oh man, did I have five porters?
Stoked on that brewery.
I had five porters. It was a good night.
I had three beers, which is pretty good for me.
Yeah.
So luckily we were staying in the motel right up the street.
Right.
So we could just kind of stagger on home.
Mm-hmm.
It was only 7 in the evening.
Right. And we did not leave until a mandatory checkout at 11 a.m. So today is our rest day, more or less, even though we did like 40 miles on it.
Yeah.
But now here we are waiting for it to rain. I need to wash the salt out of my clothes.
So I did want to mention how,
yeah.
you know, so the other week, so, okay, I've been listening to this Sparket podcast and,
me too.
It's good. I love it. So keeps me going. Couple of thoughts. One thought was when I bike or do something where I'm driving myself to the point of exhaustion, I lose my, my rich vocabulary and I immediately sink into using words such as,
fuck, shit,
or stoked,
oh, or that,
or
okay.
Or fist bump,
oh sure,
or for the win, which we were laughing at that guy who made that movie about rock climbing and bike touring through Kazakhstan. So to illustrate this, yesterday we were 2 days ago we were going up a mountain pass, and these kind of Freds out for a ride gained on me, and they were coming up, and I say something to them, and then I was like, I'm just so stoked on this road, you guys. And I wished I could have eaten my words because I can't believe I just actually put those words into a sentence.
Well, so it goes.
But it happens.
And they were riding a lot faster than we were.
Yeah. So I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to judge people.
I'm not going to judge. Yeah.
Oh, there's the first big drop of rain.
Here it comes. Well, I suppose it's a good time to wrap up.
Yeah, I hope that was all right.
It was great.
Did we do okay?
I think we did okay.
We're not drinking any beers,
we're
so
not.
And I wasn't drunk last update. Brock thought maybe I was.
Okay.
But I was just pretending to be drunk.
Just so that's on the record.
I was impersonating.
Just so you know.
A drunk. Now we're not. We have no beer tonight. Why? We just don't have any beer.
We don't have any beer. We had a lot of beer last night.
We had so much beer last night.
It was a good night.
Yeah, we're just gonna enjoy the sounds of the rain.
Rain. All right.
All right. Are we going?
We are going.
We're
week
going.
5. My name is Brock.
My name's Adele.
And we are sitting next to Cold Creek off of Lake Keechalis.
If you don't know who we are, no.
If you don't know who we are, yeah.
Stop listening.
I suppose.
It
no.
will interest you.
You can keep listening if you want.
Okay. Well, we're sitting by Cold Creek.
Yeah. I don't know if Keechalis is the right pronunciation or not, but we're up near Snoqualmie Pass.
And if you don't know where that is, it's in Washington State.
Stop listening.
Stop listening. If you don't know where Snoqualmie Pass is, go home. Not worth your time.
If they don't know where Snoqualmie
Pass
is,
we're not worth your time.
There's no way of knowing how to go home.
Go do something useful.
A week ago. A week ago. We were in Beaver Lake, and it was about to rain, and it did.
Damn.
And it got everything wet. And I believe that was the lightning that struck and started all the wildfires that are now burning in North Washington.
There were miles and miles of tinder just waiting to be sparked upon, and then the apocalypse happened.
So it seems, yeah. Well, we went from Beaver Lake downhill to Tenasket, which was a lovely downhill ride of about 20 miles. And we did it all before it got super hot, because that was the week that the temperatures were supposed to be up above 100.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was about 105 for at least 3 days.
Yeah, which sounds pretty inhuman to me, and I was pretty freaked out about it. But
yeah.
It turned out, like, we would finish by noon or 1 every day, and if you can swing that, it's okay to bike in 105, or on a day where the high is going to be 105 degrees.
The trick is you start early.
Like,
and
5
Yeah,
o'clock.
We would get up at 5 and finish our breakfast and wrap up and move out.
Which is hard for us because, well, not that hard, but it's unusual. Usually we wake up at about 8.
Usually we don't have a set wake-up time.
And we're on the road by 9:30 or even 10.
But that kind of heat necessitates it. So
yeah.
We made it to OMAC before noon, and you found a pool.
Oh, my God.
It was so good.
So much fun at that swimming pool. It was like the three best spent dollars I've ever used. So I jumped off. They even had a high dive, and these tiny little kids were going off of it. And so I was like, well, if five-year-olds can jump off this high dive in their life jackets, I can. And I was like the only person there over 12.
You were.
I was like paddling around with these kiddos.
You started in the adult swim, and then you ended in the all swim.
Yeah, and then this one little boy like kept following me around and was like, watch my Superman dive. I'm going to go on the board you're going on. And then he'd like cut me. So it was pretty cute. I had a great time at the OMAC pool.
Aw.
And you kind of watched me. Well, you read your book. You didn't watch me the whole time. That'd be weird.
I did not watch you.
Yeah.
I barely saw you.
Who's that man watching me?
That'd be creepy.
Yeah, you hung out in the shade as the temperatures rose higher and higher.
But the park at the OMAC Stampede Grounds is nice and shaded.
Yeah.
We had iced coffees that afternoon because we could not be outdoors. I mean, we could have been, but it was very hot.
It was outrageous.
So I found some Steinbeck and you found some Thomas Hardy.
Yeah.
And then we stayed with Parker, who is a Warm Showers host.
Yeah.
He himself does not bicycle tour, but he's the only host in OMAC, and a lot of people go through there doing the northern cross-country route.
Yeah, it sounds like he gets pretty slammed.
Yeah. And that day he was slammed because he had the two of us and another guy named Ron, who was 73.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And we may have caught him slightly off guard, so sorry, Parker, if we overwhelmed you. But he hosted us well and gave us a place to sleep.
We were pretty loud and excited to be inside and cooking real food. So we may have been a little off-putting in our gregariousness. And Ron was kind of hanging out. Well,
Ron was hanging out without really any clothes on. He had like a pair of Bermuda shorts, and that was it.
Funny.
And I think it's fair to say he was saggy.
Yeah.
So, you know, all much love to all of our saggy friends.
Yes.
Someday I will be. I hope at 73. Yeah.
Biking hundreds of miles.
Indeed.
I won't care if I'm saggy, and you better not care.
I will not. The next day was my birthday. And we rode down to Lake Chelan and camped out there. The campground was full, and the fellow who had been pulled in to run the office while someone went to lunch did not know that there was supposed to be hiker-biker sites available.
Kind of sad.
So we were very nearly turned away.
Yeah.
But the park manager was just on her way out, and she said, no, you can give them a hiker-biker space.
And he would have sent us to our death because it was 105 degrees again that day, and it was already 1 o'clock.
He would have sent us to extreme discomfort.
So thank God that lady was there.
Indeed.
So we ended up having a wonderful afternoon.
We did.
And Lake Chelan is pretty cold, but that was a very welcome relief for the day. And you had a birthday six-pack of IPA.
I drank so much IPA. It was a good birthday.
Yeah, we normally eat baked beans and instant mashed potatoes every day, but we had a special celebratory dinner for you, which is jalapeno cheddar dogs.
We boiled sausages
because there was a fire ban.
There was a fire ban because of the forest fires, which makes sense.
It was delicious. Happy birthday, Brock.
Thank you. I am 32.
You're halfway to 64.
Yeah.
Like the Beatles song.
I don't know if this is the case with all Washington State parks, because I know Battleground Lake in Vancouver, just north of Portland, also has a deal where hiker, biker, campers can sleep in the day use area for a mere $12.
And don't test this theory.
Yeah, if you're traveling in a group of two, that's still very affordable. So I actually put it out on Twitter trying to find out from Washington State Parks, is this an across-the-board policy or is it only at certain parks? I don't know.
You tried to Google it, right?
They said it was a fish eagle.
And it didn't quite give us the answer we wanted.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyways, that was nice.
But, yeah, I mean, so far it seems like every Washington State Park that we've shown up at, if the employees are kind of knowing what they're doing,
right,
they'll direct us to the day use area.
So you have to find the right employees.
When Nat was just crawling, like, under the bottom of your glasses,
I saw
really
the Nat on my lens.
Gross. Anyways.
Yeah. We stayed with my relatives in Wenatchee for 2 days.
That was
and
so fun.
And saw a bunch of people, and it was great. It's nice
to... Wenatchee is, like, coming up in the world.
It is.
Like, high culture pastimes of which to partake, like French bistro food and breweries.
The Pybus Market is great. Badger Mountain Brewing is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks at the Forest Service are very hardworking. They were slammed with stuff to do because of all the forest fires, but we went in and found out that we could not go over Highway 20 as we planned, could not go over Highway 2. Yeah. And so all of our plans to go to Mount Vernon were decimated. But that sent us down south towards Cle Elum. We stayed on Blewett Pass last night.
It doesn't suck that bad. I was pretty disappointed.
It sucks much more for anyone who was driven out of their homes or has to fight the fires.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, actually, we should mention, like, we biked through that little town, Pateras, on
yes,
our way down
we
to
did.
Lake Chelan.
Pateras, Washington.
And then literally, like, 2 days later, the town was gone.
Just about.
From wildfire. Mm-hmm, I mean, maybe the school and the maybe some other things by the river were left standing. The state park where we were going to camp going back north a few days, that was obliterated by fire. I mean, it was crazy.
It's been a very severe summer. This is the first time we've ever been on a trip where we've been so close to natural disaster.
Yeah, we got kind of close 2 years ago in Colorado, but by the time we got to Fort Collins, the fires had been kind of, they died down for a few weeks.
Yeah, there was a lot of smoke in the air on our way to Wenatchee, and then on our way out, you could see the smoke from the fires up north.
People were walking around with masks on their faces,
and
your grandma couldn't go outside because it was just too smoky.
She's a little sensitive. She stayed indoors.
Yeah.
And, the whole river valley, usually it's clear. You can see the ski area across the river from where they live on the hill. But the entire place was filled with smoke.
Your aunts were put off because their pool was covered with a thin film of ash.
It's true.
We still swam in it.
We did.
Put us off.
The water smelled like smoke.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Ooh.
But it was very nice of them to have us over.
You could probably sell that in a tea shop in Portland.
Maybe. So, we camped on Blewett Pass. One more pass under our belts.
It was an easy pass.
Yeah. We wild camped last night for free on Forest Service Road.
It was weird to be surrounded by so much green grass because we've been on the east side for so long where the main color palette is kind of gold and brown.
It was shocking to see things
evergreen.
Growing.
But we were like camping in this like lush meadow of grass. It was beautiful.
And then from Cle Elum, we have been on the Iron Horse Trail. It's like the John Wayne Pioneer Trail in Ironhorn. He did not come here. It's true. Never been. But there are some cowboys that like John Wayne, and they named their group after him. At Iron Horse State Park, the old line of the Milwaukee Road Railway, went to Chicago.
John Wayne was a great champion of bicycle travel.
Yes, he was.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Sure he was.
So here we are, camped on Lake Kichelas, and it's a beautiful place. Tomorrow we go through the 2.5-mile tunnel underneath Snoqualmie Pass.
That's right. That's exactly what we're going to do, Brock.
After 5 weeks, how do you feel?
Oh, I feel good. My saddle sores have died down, and my skin has turned reptilian in areas. My knees are good.
My knees are tired.
I feel good. We're reading some good books.
We are.
Seeing some beautiful things.
We are. Although I found out that Hemingway...
Ooh.
Well, at least The Sun Also Rises is just about rich people problems. So it's not that interesting.
Yeah, we're getting some high culture. But I feel good. Now that it's been 5 weeks, things are kind of blurring for me. Like, I think the first 3 weeks were a little more crystal clear in my mind about, like, what each day was. But now I'm just like, I don't know how long I've been on the road. And just kind of going into that, I don't know, just kind of this zone of... blur.
Yeah, and right now...
It's weird. But I feel like when we have only 2 weeks left to our trip, then things again will kind of crystallize again.
Crystallize, because we have to go home.
Yeah, and I'll start maybe... maybe valuing it in a different way.
Okay.
I think I value the middle of the trip in a much different way than I value the beginning and the end of a long trip.
Mm.
So I don't know if you felt that before, but...
Well, the middle of the trip is where the changes occurred most definitively. And I've been reading Steinbeck, and his quote is that you don't take a journey, the journey takes you.
Mm.
It's like a marriage. When you find out you can't control it, then you understand it.
Because your wife controls it.
Hey-ho. Happy week 5, everybody who's hearing this. We will talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right, there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode with Jonathan Mouse and Brock and Adele's week 4 and 5 update. I'm going to close this thing out. first by turning that up. There we go. Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics or guests. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call and leave us a message or text us at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Thanks to Herbert for our headline sounder. Thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, Katrina Mellengard, Roger Grigsby, Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson, Ethan Georgie, Justin Martin, Eric Ivertson, and special thanks to Cameron Lean for being our new donor. Brush your teeth.
Production.